Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. My name is Bronwyn and I'm here with Tracy and Tanea, and we're sitting across from debut Australian author Jessica Townsend, who's here to talk to us about her new book, Nevermore. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming in. So I guess we should start with the fact that you have had incredible success right off the bat. What has that been like?
Bit weird.
Yeah.
No, it has been a bit weird. It's been, it's been a year since kind of the whole malarkey of the book deal and Frankfurt and blah, blah, blah. But it feels like it's been a week. Like it just feels like this whole year has gone really quickly. A lot of stuff has happened. It's amazing. Like, I'm thrilled, obviously, but I also feel like I kind of hit a ceiling really early on for like, can't be any more shocked than I am now, so I'm just like butting against that ceiling of shock, like constantly.
I don't know. I feel like you'd be surprised. You never know where it could go and how much it'll grow. And
Does something else that becomes the new butt of the level of shock?
Yeah, just keep pushing that ceiling up there.
Just when you thought it wouldn't get any crazier.
With all the hype, I remember reading about the Frankfurt deals and everything, and pointing out to these guys.
Yeah, I remember
about
what
the
you
book.
Told us.
Oh, really?
Who is this author?
But does it put extra pressure on you, particularly with writing the second and the third books in the trilogy?
I mean, it's been an interesting experience writing the second book, and I'll be totally honest about it. Like, it's a totally different beast to writing the first book, because the first book, I mean, I took 10 years to write it. I'm a procrastinator from way back. And I didn't have a deadline. I didn't have an audience. I was very secretive, and I never kind of let anyone read anything except my sister occasionally. I would drip feed little bits to her. I have just with my English publishers alone, I've got 5 editors on 3 continents, and I can feel their eyeballs like in the room with me every time I put my fingers on the keyboard.
Every time you procrastinate, you're like, they're watching.
Yeah, literally like that. But on the flip side of that, like, I have amazing support from them, from my publisher and from my agent, and like, I feel very embraced by these people and very kind of protected and nurtured, and it's the whole thing has been a really good experience, so it's good. Minimal stress.
So with having 5 editors across different continents, does that mean each version of the book is going to be slightly different, or
no, so they are all basically, it's my Australian editor, 2 American editors and 2 UK editors, and they kind of work together.
Okay.
When they receive the manuscript, so they kind of go through and give their notes, and then they provide kind of one united kind of edit letter at the end.
Interesting.
I'm
interested because with with Harry Potter, the very first book, it was very different for the US market than the Australian and the UK market.
Yep.
So
I see what you mean.
I wondered whether there's going to be slight differences based on region, because
definitely there are the English and the Australian versions are much of a muchness, but there are those small differences for the American market. So, you know, jumpers become sweaters and stuff like that, which, I mean, it doesn't... I know that some people get kind of funny about that, and I think that I was a little bit funny about that when I learned that my favourite books that I read when growing up were being treated that way. But as an author, I just think, well, I want every kid who reads it to have the best understanding of it that makes sense to them in their world. You know, it's like translating it into French or something. Like, it's just that there are just a few little words that need translating.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves. For the people who are listening who don't know what your book is about, can you give us a little rundown of what Nevermore is about?
Yes, I've been working on my elevator pitch.
Yes, it's good.
I'm not very good at it. Nevermore is about a little girl called Morrigan Crow, who lives in a world that is not our world, and she's cursed. So she was born on the wrong day, and that curse has meant that she is blamed for everything that goes wrong in this place that she's from. So little things like a little boy loses a spelling bee, and big things like there's a flood, she's to blame, and so she kind of grows up with the weight of that on her shoulders. But in addition, the curse means that she's going to die on a certain day, and she knows that when that day comes. But what happens is that she does not die, in fact. It would be a little bit bleak. She instead is kind of whisked off into this secret city called Nevermore by this strange ginger man.
that really sums him up, doesn't it?
Right.
Strange ginger man, Jupiter.
Yeah, exactly. So Jupiter North takes her, and she goes to live in this place, the Hotel Deucalion, in Nevermore, which is this kind of magical, strange hotel. And she's invited to participate in trials to join the Wondrous Society, which is an organisation of kind of remarkable people who all have some kind of special talent, but she does not have a talent.
Yeah. Story of my life. Sounds like
no.
So, as if it took... do you remember back 10 years or so ago when you started writing it? Where did your ideas come from? Like, where did you wake up one morning and just go, aha, well, I have this girl in my head and I must write about her?
I remember when Morrigan popped into my head, I was in a conference for something and I was like...
Daydreaming.
Literally that. Like, there was this keynote speech and I was like, this is so boring. I was... I was 18 or 19 and I was, like, kind of making notes about, you know... a story that I wanted to write. Originally, Morrigan Crow was an adult character. She was. It was this little story I was planning to write about a girl who goes to live with her aunt Morrigan, and her aunt was this eccentric woman who is, you know, very funny and sharp-witted and interesting. And then I just became much more interested in her as a character, and I was like, well, who was she? Where did she grow up? What happened to her in her childhood to kind of make her this remarkable woman? And she also had this adult best friend called Hawthorne Swift, who was quite funny. And then that's kind of where that came from. And then also when I was 22, I moved to London. And much of Nevermore is based on this experience of London that I was having. So really specific things like, you know, the Wonderground is obviously based on the London Underground, and so on. But then also just like in a general way, you know, just that feeling that Morrigan has when she comes to this city that she didn't know existed. I mean, I didn't know London existed. I wasn't planning to move to London. I didn't really think that I would like it, to be honest, because I grew up on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, which is quite a pleasant place, and I never wanted to live in a city particularly. So I was like, I had some friends who were living there, and I was doing the thing that you do in your 20s where you move to London. And then it turned out that I loved it, and I just felt like it belonged to me. maybe that's not quite right, but like I just was like, this is my city, this is where I belong, I love it. And it felt like this, without wanting to be too kind of naff about it, like it did feel like this weird, bizarre, magical place, because there's so many layers to it, and there's so much history and so many interesting people. And so for me, like, the whole book is steeped in that feeling of like, I didn't know this was there, and, you know, how have I gone my whole life without it?
I think that's a feeling a lot of people have when they go to London.
Right? It's special.
It sounds familiar, but, you know, I've been there. There's something different about it.
But if you look at, like, a lot of the classic kids' middle grade tales, they're all kind of English, and they're based around, like, very English sensibilities. And this book has that kind of very English sensibility. It kind of... echoes of like Roald Dahl and like Mary Poppins and, you know, obviously Harry Potter and like some of the other classic kids stories. But did you intentionally set out to have those sort of overtures in the book?
Yeah, I mean, look, that for me, the book came out the way that it came out, and I grew up reading those books. I also grew up watching a lot of, I mean, we loved, you know, like English television in my family. So, you know, I think I grew up with this, like, very much influenced by the English sense of humour and that kind of absurdity that they have. So I think it was always going to look something like that. Definitely, like, in an overt way, like, this has extremely English sensibilities, like, you can hear the, you know, like, I think if I've written a northern accent or something in there, like, you can kind of see what I was trying to, well, I hope you can see what I was trying to do. maybe you can't, I don't know.
Jupiter, to me, felt very, kind of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Mr. Wonka kind of.
Yeah, I mean, there's that archetype kind of like the eccentric kind of wise, strange mentor, and I mean that's a conscious choice, because, you know, like using tropes. I mean, it feels like tropes is like a dirty word now, but I just don't think that it is. They're tropes for a reason. And also, they're useful. You know, they're a useful shortcut into a story. They're a great way to give, especially with kids, but with adults as well when you're reading. Like, they give you context. Mm. They give you something to grasp onto. And then, you know, tropes can also be subverted. And
it's kind of a sense of comfort.
Exactly.
People are picking up a certain genre for a specific reason. They know roughly what to expect.
Right.
The kinds of themes that are going to appear. And that is point of a trope. It's comforting.
I have to say, one of my favorite characters was the cat.
Me too.
Cat person.
You know, everyone says that. That's Fenn's everyone's favorite character. She's mine as well. I love her. So the weird thing is, people always ask me, you know, either did you base the characters on anyone, or like, is there any actors that you want to play these characters in movies? And the answer is always no, because they just were the people in my head. Yeah. There's always little bits of, you know, people that I know and myself in them. But the weird thing is that Fenn is kind of the one exception to that, because without me planning it in any way, the voice that she speaks in my head and has always spoken in my head is, do you know the comedian Jo Brand?
No.
Have you ever watched QI?
No.
Okay. Someone out there listening to this podcast definitely knows who Jo Brand is. Yeah, she's so funny and she's so dry and witty. And for some reason, like, I don't know why, maybe I was watching a lot of QI at the time, I'm not sure. She's just always spoken in that voice. When you check her out on YouTube, you'll be like, oh yeah, that's totally
that's
As I was reading it, it reminded me of the cat from Alice in Wonderland, particularly the last two movies.
Right.
And I always had that almost, even though it was a female cat, I had that kind of droll voice from the movie in my head as I was reading it.
Very similar. No, I love. I've got a soft spot for Fenn, because I mean, I've known a lot of people like Fenn. you know, they kind of put on this very grouchy, tough exterior, but there's a lot of hidden emotion under there.
So. I know a lot of cats like that.
Yeah, I know. I've owned some cats like that. I should say I've shared a house with cats like that.
Is there a character you think is most like you, or not really?
Look, I think. I mean, I would never go and base a character myself. That would be really weird. But I think there are little bits of... I do see little bits of me in all these characters. And I've had... You know, a few of my friends have now started to read the book. And I've had... I got a text message from a friend the other day who was like, you know that conversation that Jupiter has with Morrigan about giving her a nickname? You had that conversation with me when we met several years ago. She literally was like, no, you... It was pretty much that. I have no memory of this. I didn't do it deliberately. Like, I wasn't practicing it to write in the book or anything. But, you know, there's little bits like that that definitely come straight from me. I mean, like, look, it's kind of just me on the page. Like, my values are all in there. You get a pretty good idea of, like, just, you know, my sense of humour and the things I find funny, and also, like, the values that I have, because it's just... It's in all
I
mean, of
that's
them.
How books get written from life experiences. So it's funny when people make those remarks of like, oh, that character's like me to the author. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, I've got to take my inspiration from someone.
You
know,
there are a few little specific things, like when Jupiter says when someone says, oh, where is she from, and he says Nunya. My brother used to say that all the time as well. That's such an Australian thing to say, like, none your business. he says that to me all the time now. And also when Hawthorne's like, I pinky promise, and I've never broken a pinky promise in my life, my childhood best friend Dean, who is in some ways quite similar to Hawthorne, he used to say that to me. That was when he used to say, I've never broken a pinky promise in my life. I'm not sure that's true. But
he's been called out.
Yeah, but he still says it now, and we take pinky promises very seriously. I agree.
So there's talk about, well, there's the film. Tell us about that.
I mean, I can't really tell anything. There is some stuff, but I've sort of been sworn to secrecy. But it's, I mean, it was, sorry, go on.
More about what do you have hopes in regards to, like, where it might be set, or any actors, or now that it is a
I honestly have not thought about it much, just because I think, well, I don't know. It's a weird thing. Like, I'm thrilled. Obviously, I'm thrilled about the movie deal. It was genuinely not a thing that I considered before. I mean, it happened really early on, and when my agent said, oh, so this... Because obviously I had a different, like, a film agent for that side of things, and she said, oh, yeah, so you know, Dana's read the manuscript, she wants to represent it, she went, I was like, oh, okay. Okay, great. Like, because Frankfurt was happening and everything else was happening at the same time, I was like, went totally over my head, and I thought, all right, well, we'll hear about that in 5 years. Yeah. and then, like, a couple of weeks later, I was like, okay, so... And I felt so... I mean, I genuinely felt quite frightened about it. I know that sounds so disingenuous, but, like, just because it suddenly felt... You know, I wanted my book to be a book and a shelf, and then it suddenly felt like... this is going to be taken away from me. It's the good thing is about Fox is that they're, you know, they do want to work with me. They want me to love it. They, you know, and they have a lot of love and affection for it. So, so I will get some saying things, not, you know, not in everything, but, I have not thought about actors or anything like that. Because again, I feel so protective of these characters that I'm just like, oh, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'll throw that question back on you. Were you picturing people as you were reading?
Ooh. I didn't. Like, I just have my own characters in my head, how I envision them. So, yeah. And yeah. I'm sure once there is a movie that might change, but for now, right. They're how I picture them in my head. So yeah. I didn't think of anyone. Even now, I'm not thinking of anyone because I feel like whoever they do, they'll do it justice, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like it's such dangerous territory because once you think of someone, what if they just get stuck in my brain? Mm. Although having said that, like having weirdly the voice of Joe Brand in my head, I feel like it did give Fen a certain specificity in her voice. You know, so maybe
Joe Brand needs to be the voice.
For Fen. You know what I mean? It's almost like that's a good way in. It's like if I picture this specific person delivering this line, maybe it gives more voice on the page. I don't know. I've never tried to write like that. Maybe I should.
I could picture someone like Maggie Smith doing Finn because that kind of McGonagall character in Harry Potter, like, you know, being stern and you know, like being kind of almost like the headmaster kind of.
Yes, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, because Finn comes across a bit as being like the adult in the story, more so than most of the other characters.
Right, yeah.
You know,
she's like the voice of reason,
child that does what he wants, and
which is why he's so entertaining.
Is there a particular part you're excited to see in movie form?
I'm really. I can't say the one I want because it's kind of a spoiler for anyone who hasn't read it. So I will leave that one.
Choose another one.
I would be fascinated to see what someone did with Jupiter because I think I think there are different ways to interpret Jupiter North, and I think that especially for the idea of him that I have in my head, I'm not sure how much of it comes across in book one because for me, I'm just seeing kind of the whole big picture, but he is quite kind of quirky and whimsical and, you know, he's very strange and he's funny and he's such a bad adult. Like he doesn't, you know, he's so not good at adulting. But also he has this kind of thread of darkness as well. Like when you see him get serious, he could potentially be someone who's quite threatening. So I would be interested to see what someone did with that actually.
So with the first book left us on a cliffhanger, which I won't talk about because we don't want to have spoilers. Any spoilers. But is the second book likely to be a little bit more darker? Because the end of this book seemed to take it was quite light most of the way through, and then the end kind of got a little bit darker.
Stakes definitely went up.
Yeah. So are we likely to see a sort of slightly more darker story in the second one? Or?
Yes. I mean, look, it definitely, things get a little bit more serious, but also there's more ridiculousness as well. And that's something that's important to me because those are the kinds of stories that I love are the stories that, you know, they take the very serious kind of dark parts of life and then put them right alongside the absurd and the ridiculous, and also taking both of those things seriously. I love books like Harry Potter does it really well, but also have you read the Gregory Maguire book, Wicked? So, you know, obviously that was not a world that he created, but he took this very kind of childlike world of Oz and then treated it in such a serious way and just gave it all so much weight. So that's what I like, is that I like kind of turning on a dime and having things be kind of funny and light and then
ripping it all away.
Exactly, tearing hearts out.
Tearing hearts.
So in terms of the story, and this is maybe kind of like your year 11 English kind of question, but what do you hope that kids or adults
mm-hmm.
take away from the story? Do you have some, you know, messages that...
I mean, I never kind of wrote it in a, like, didactic way or,
mm-hmm.
like, a, it's not... Obviously, there are some serious themes in there and there are some serious things that kind of reflect our own world. There's the subplot of the fact that Morrigan is essentially, you know, an illegal immigrant
mm.
who is kind of being hunted in that way and always has this threat hanging over her, and that reflects our own world, sadly. So, I mean, I haven't written this with, like, particular messages
yeah.
or themes in mind, but, I mean, you know, for me, it's a book about... Long pause. That was a really long pause. And then, like, halfway through that pause, I thought, this is a long pause. And then so the second half of the pause was just me thinking about
long
how
pause,
long I haven't been speaking.
No,
okay. So what I was going to say, you know, there's, and again, I don't kind of want to give too much away
no.
for anyone who hasn't
yeah.
read it, but there is a conversation towards the end of the book, which is basically saying, well, you know, a big part of the plot in here is that Morrigan doesn't know what her talent is. She doesn't know what this
yeah.
skill is that she brings to the world. And then, you know, that the conversation of the end is like, well, that's been the big thing all along, but that's never been the most
mm.
important thing. Because
that was the thing that I sort of took, one of the big things I took away was that whole pressure of having to prove yourself and little kids with, you know, this kind of pressure
yeah.
to have a talent.
Yeah.
And what that did to her and,
exactly, and you know, it kind of it messes with her head for the
mm.
entire book, and
yeah.
then at the end the story is, well, you know, if that was the most important thing about you, then we would have, you know, again, like, it's probably not going to make sense to anyone who hasn't read the book, but for anyone who has, you know, that's the last trial, and
mm.
if it wasn't, we wouldn't have, you know, sorry, if it was the most important thing, like, all of these other trials that came before that were, you know, trying to figure out if you were brave and resourceful
mm.
and resilient and blah, blah, blah. Like, those are the much more important qualities than...
And I really loved that message at the end.
Yeah,
that
thank
line.
You.
I just thought, that's really beautiful. It's something that we really need to get out there, so...
Mm. It's something that adult, I mean, myself, like, you have to tell yourself that all the time. It's like,
absolutely.
There are so many more important qualities
yeah.
than, you know, whatever your weird talent is or whatever.
So you're writing book 2.
Yes.
And obviously you said that, you know, you're feeling that pressure to sort of keep on top of it all. But do you have a lot of other stories that are in your head nagging, you know, write me, or are you...
No, do you know what? I really don't.
Yes,
that's right. I mean, occasionally, so I mean, I had an idea for this kind of duology a little while ago that I thought, but in like, honestly... This has been the one story that stuck with me, and I think it will just stick with me until I get it all out. And maybe I'll write other things in the meantime.
You could even write other things in the world. I mean, it's such a rich world and so many.
This is the thing. It's a
big
kitchen sink in that
yeah.
all of the, you know, like I probably, the things that are in this book, I probably could have kind of filtered them out into different ideas, but instead every kind of weird idea I had, I was like, well, I'll just put it in Nevermore. that's the thing, is like, and that's what I love about world building as well, is that, you know, you can create this place where literally anything could happen, and any of these characters in this book, I could probably write a story about them, because
mm-hmm.
you know, I kind of just
that.
Think obsessive, right?
That would be a great book.
The backstory, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I do kind of start to think slightly obsessively about who is this person? What are, you know, who do they know and who do they know, you know? So that's okay. I guess that's the benefit of like having, I'm sitting on an iceberg of what
yeah.
I know about these people in this world. So
you know, it would be great, a book about Fenn, like a backstory, like a Timon and Pumbaa backstory. That kind of movie. That's what I'm picturing now for the movie, but about Fenn and then like her family or whatever. You'd be like, oh,
yeah. Animated. I love it.
Exactly.
Big squashy face.
Yeah. Everyone's glowering.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it would be the origin story of, she used to be all smiley and now why is she glowering?
Yeah.
Or
she's
why.
Like the black sheep, the black cat of
yeah.
her family. She came from this perfect, like the aristocrats. They're all happy and she's like the grumpy one.
And then she
the
ends
corner.
Up at the hotel and be like...
Oh, I'm just going to write all this down.
So do you have reams and reams of writing, like on the backstories or planning the books out? I mean, we were talking to another author just recently and she said that she puts so much effort into planning it. She's almost written the novel as she's planning it. But do you spend a lot of time on the planning?
Yeah, I do. I'm definitely a planner and a plotter. And I do, because I've been writing this for so long, I've carried, like, the laptops that I've had in the last 10 years. You know, I've just carried, you know, documents over from laptop. It's a graveyard. So, and the way I've structured it is, like, it's slightly haphazard, but I've done it. So I'll have, like, folders for years, and then I have a folder for each month. So, like, every time I think, what was that thing? And when did I think of that? Like, I have to go back and try and find it in the right month. Yeah, and also then notebooks and all that. And, yeah, so, I mean, I plot a lot of it, but then also there are some things that just when you actually sit down to write, it takes you by surprise. Yeah. And I'm like, well, where did that come from? I don't know why I've gone on this tangent but or this, like, sudden turn. But I do plot a lot, though.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming and talking. I think that was a good chat.
Yeah,
that was fun.
What a blast.
We're very excited for book two, so.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So don't procrastinate, because we want it.
I know, I need to stop telling people. I'm like, yeah, I'm a procrastinator. I took 10 years to write the first book. See you in another 10.
But now you've got the grill on you. Like,
yeah.
Come on.
Please don't do a Georgia Armand at all.
Yeah. No. Yeah, and my editors get a slightly funny look in their eye when I make jokes like that. I have to protect them a little bit.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
And podcast listeners, you can get Nevermore online at booktopia.com.au.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.